This time, please help me welcome our speaker, Frank S. from Philly.
Testing. Hello, everyone. My name is Frank Spina. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey.
And I'm sore. I just worked today. It's the first time I've actually did physical work since September. I've been laid off. I'm a union carpenter. I feel like somebody beat me with a chair. But that's okay. I'd like to thank Dave for asking me to come up here and share my experience, strength, and hope. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's nice to be invited anywhere today. You know, for a long time in my life, I was never invited any place. Matter of fact, there were a lot of people who never wanted me around because let's face it, most of us know how we are in the act of illness. You know, we're angry, we're resentful, we push people away from us. We don't want anybody around us because we don't want to hurt anybody. And that seemed like that was my MO for a lot of years. You know, I didn't start out planning on being alcoholic. You know, I don't know. I came from a good family. My mom and dad, you know, were blue collar people. Mom stayed home, cooked, cleaned. Dad went to work every day. Neither one of my parents were alcoholic. I was raised in a good family where we were taught morals, we were taught right from wrong. Definitely taught about God. I was raised up in a Catholic upbringing. My parents were the type of people who would do without just so that me and my sister could have. And for some reason, it just wasn't enough. I was an honor student. I was a choir boy. I was an older boy. I was very involved in my church, and you know, my parish, when I was a young kid. I always had people looking at me and saying, "There's Frank, he's a good kid." And I was. You know, I was always doing something for somebody. But I never realized that there were even selfish motives back then until I came into AA and did the work I needed to do. See, I was an older boy, but I liked getting the attention from the people watching me carry that cross up the middle of the aisle at 12:30 Mass, you know. I always had to be the one to ring the bells up on the altar. Make sure that everything was the way I wanted it to be. I got straight A's because I got recognition for it. That didn't last too long, though. Like I said, for the most part, by society's eyes, I shouldn't even be standing here because I was raised right. By social stigma, there's no reason why I should have turned out the way that I did, but I did. Because deep inside of me, somewhere inside of me, I always felt like there was some sort of void. I always felt like there was something missing in there. And no matter what I tried to do, I never could fill it up with anything. You know, whether it be attention, whether it be money, pretty women, being the class clown. Just go on and on. I didn't just keep going on. And I can't really explain why I was like that. The big book explains it pretty easy, that I was a selfish, self-centered person. Although I didn't think so. And somewhere around the age of 12, I split a bottle of wine with a friend of mine. And let's face it, it wasn't the greatest tasting stuff in the world. I think it cost about 89 cents. You know, it was... It was not something that you would find in your fine Italian restaurant. It didn't have a cork. there wasn't no date on it or born on date or whatever it was. It smelled really bad. It looked like somebody left a bottle of grape juice out in the sun for about 3 years. It had that swirl to it, you know, like that cheap Muscatel, like it's got that Mad Dog swirl, I like to call it. And out of wanting to fit in, out of not wanting to be an outcast, I put in 50 cents. My buddy put in 50 cents. We got a bottle of this stuff. It was called Golden Spur. I mean, that alone tells you that it's dangerous. You know, Golden Spur. I mean, the label looked like somebody printed it off a copying machine, you know. And we cracked it open, and we were sitting under I-95. It was a hot summer day like this, and they were just starting to bring I-95 through South Philadelphia. So I'm talking about 1966, 67, okay. There's a few people that are old enough out there to remember them dates, right? And hi, Sharon. How you doing, honey? Good to see you. And my friend picked this bottle of wine up. It was warm and it smelled bad. And he guzzled some of it. He gave some to me. I guzzled it. We switched it back and forth, you know, and the bottle was finished, and he jumped up like it was nothing, slapped his hand and said, come on, let's go play some basketball. He jumped up, ran away. I jumped up, flat on my face. Didn't remember what happened, where I was, if I did anything to anybody for the next 7 or 8 hours. The only thing I do remember is that Mrs. McGuire, who had a porch front property around the corner from me, I lived in the city, so we had all row homes. Some of them had porch fronts, some of them didn't. And she called my dad. My neighbor was very tight. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody had everybody's phone numbers. It was like one big, you know, like coffee clutch, you know. But it was a tight neighborhood. Everybody helped each other out. It was a good neighborhood. And she told my dad that I was laying on her porch, vomiting and soiling myself, and that if he didn't come around and get me, she was going to call the police and have them remove me. So needless to say, my father, who was about a 5'7", 170-pound, very built, strong Italian man, came around and walked up to Mrs. McGuire's porch, grabbed me by the hair, punched me in the face, and drug me down the street like a caveman. That was the first time my father ever laid his hands on me. I had never been hit by my dad up to that point. He took me home. I don't know what was worse. He threw me into bed. I don't know what was worse. The room spinning, the blood coming out of my nose, the vomit coming out of my face, you know. Me hugging the pillow, hoping that it would all stop soon, which it didn't. And being punished for the first time in my life. Never been punished. Never done anything to be punished for. I was a good kid. So that Sunday I had to go to church because, being a nice, good little Catholic boy, Sister Mary Holy Car was taking attendance, you know, and we had to go to church at 8 o'clock Mass in your little suit and tie, and she'd be there, Francis, yeah, he's here, right? And I was hungover, I felt like crap, and naturally I squeeze in and I sit with my friends. And I'm looking, and they're looking, they're giving me like these really like weird looks. So after church is done, we're sitting in the back of the church, and they're standing there. And my one buddy turns around and he says, what the hell happened to you yesterday? I said, what are you talking about? He said, man, he says, you were bopping on the corner. He says, dancing, and you went over to so-and-so, and she gave you her phone number, and she wants you to take her to the dance Saturday or the movie. I never talked to women. I was scared to death to talk to a woman. That alcohol gave me enough courage to be able to walk up to this girl and ask her if I could take her somewhere. I was scared to death of women. I was scared to death of people. Alcohol took that fear away real quick. And even though I didn't remember what I was doing or whatever, I liked the fact that I was getting attention for it. My peers were giving me attention now. And then my other buddy's standing there, and he was a pretty big kid at the time. He's standing there, and he's got this big black eye, and he's looking at me all mean, and I said, "What's the matter with you? You hit me." I said, "I hit you." He says, "Yeah, I came up to you, and I said something to you. You turned around, you punched me in the face." I wasn't a fighter. I would have been scared to death to go up to somebody and hit them, let alone go up to somebody, hit them, and inflict damage on them. Alcohol gave me courage. Okay? It made me do things that I didn't want to do. It brought something out in me that I just couldn't explain. It made me the person that I always thought that I wanted to be. Okay? Now, like I said, I got punished for 2 weeks. I did that standing on my head, you know. And I can remember my mom and dad sitting me down at the dinner table, reading me the riot act before they're going to let me back out into the street. You know, the do's and don'ts of alcohol. "Yeah, Mom, I swear to God, I'll never touch another drop of my life." And this, you know, I didn't like the way it made me feel. And, you know. And I really meant it at the time. I really did. From my heart of hearts, I really honestly meant that I wasn't going to drink no more. At least until I was of age, you know. But I walked around the corner where my new friends hung. And on Friday night, they used to have a big metal trash can about this big, full of ice and a couple cases of Peel's Hugs, which are these little 8-ounce nips that you used to zip off with a pop top. And they would pack this thing up with these Peel's Hugs, and they'd sit there and they'd play handball back in the recreation center where we hung. And not thinking of the consequences, not thinking of the vomiting, the room spinning, the embarrassment I caused my family, not thinking of the 2 weeks of punishment I got, not thinking of anything, okay? I walked down them steps, went behind that recreation center, stuck my hand in that cold water, and started pulling these things out and guzzling them. And this time I actually felt the effect produced by alcohol. Okay, because I didn't get up and fall on my face. I felt that warmth go through my body. I started to feel that alcohol work, and it was doing what it was supposed to be doing, and it was making me happy. Okay? And I chased that feeling for the next 20 years. You know? And the funny thing about it is that in the beginning, you know, it was a pretty sociable time. I mean, let's face it, like I said, 1967, it was the summer of love. You know, tune in and turn on. Peace, pot, and microdot. Everybody's running around with tie-dyes on, listening to the Grateful Dead. We're heading up to Earth Day, beings at Belmont Plateau. You know, and we were having a groovy time. You know, and all my friends are 4 or 5 years older than me. So, like, some of them are going off to Vietnam. Some of them are dodging the draft. There was a lot of stuff going on. I mean, I can remember sitting home 12 years old watching the ABC Nightly News, watching people getting killed in Vietnam. It was a really crazy time. The world was all gibbetied up. Drugs and alcohol were sociable. Everybody was doing it, you know. And I just seemed to slide right in there and go along with the crowd. And for a while there, you know, it was like the Philadelphia experiment, you know, like do a couple of these with a couple of beers and go to the Spectrum and listen to some music and everything was good, you know. Nobody was getting hurt. I was able to go home, go to sleep, attend to my duties the next day, and it wasn't a necessity yet. But the thing is that it wasn't too long after that when real life started to kick in. I started to get older. You know, when we get married, responsibility. I was afraid of being responsible. You know, I wasn't in the party till I dropped because I liked that feeling. I wanted to be carefree. I didn't want to do the things that grown-up people do, you know? And while my friends all started to move on and get jobs and get married and all this kind of stuff, I started hanging out with the guys that were younger than me because they were doing what I was doing. And I didn't want to stop doing what I was doing, you know? I wasn't ready to stop. I was just having too much fun, you know? And then I had gotten a bright idea one day that, you know, like I've been going with this girl for 5 or 6 years. Maybe I should marry her. Maybe that'll settle me down. So I got married and I got a job and I went to work every day. But I made sure that I got a job where I can work third shift, you know, because most of the places I knew that people worked third shift, all they did was party all night. You know, they didn't do much work. And I wound up getting a job where my cousin was the personnel director. So he, you know, granted my wish, you know, and I fell in with a bunch of people that, let's say, partied a little more than I ever dreamed of doing. And drank a lot more than what I ever thought I would. And they were drinking whiskey at night, and they were doing harder drugs. And, you know, in order for me to fit in with this crowd, I just moved right along with it. And I can't blame them, because the thing was, is when I experienced this, it was like I found God. You know, this one thing you used to be able to do, I'd be able to stay up all night, stay up all day, drink my face off, party like a rock star. You know, do what I needed to do and play that chameleon role. See, we're good at that. We like to play 6 or 7 different roles, you know. I mean, if they gave out Oscars for best actor, they'd probably be able to give one to every alcoholic in this room. Because, let's face it, when we got to act, we act, you know. You know, we become the best bullshitters in the world. And the big part about it is we bullshit so much, we actually believe our own bullshit. You know, we actually believe that what we're doing is normal. You know? And while the normal life people are whizzing by you, you're just sitting there thinking, that's not normal. See, because the abnormal becomes normal. We cross that line. And we're, you know, like we're in Babat's land. We're nuts. I think by the time I was married 4 years, I was sleeping with a bottle of whiskey under my bed. The other substances that I was doing changed. Because I thought I was going to wind up in a loony bin with the one thing. And the other thing that I started to decide to do calmed me down a lot more. But the problem was, it was a little physically addicting, you know. And I started to do the things that I never ever thought I would do. You know, like carry a TV set out in the middle of the night. Or, you know. Ask the wife when the kid's going to grow out of the crib so I can sell it, you know. Or, gee, hon, I parked the car here. I don't know what happened to it, you know. Maybe somebody stole it, you know. By the time I was done with all that, my poor wife was sleeping on her purse, locking the door to the bedroom, just, you know, living in fear, resenting every day that she had to be in contact with me. And she came up to me one day and she said to me, she says, "You need to do something about your problem." I said, "I don't have a problem. I don't know what you're talking about." Which was, I didn't think I had a problem. I really didn't think I was that bad. She said, "Well, you're drunk all the time and you're high all the time." She says, "To me, that's a problem." And she did nothing. She barely smoked cigarettes. She was like my alter ego. She was my savior. This poor girl, she was third in her class, National Honor Society. I have no idea what she saw in me, you know, at all. But there's definitely a place in heaven for her, because she's a saint, believe me. And she put up with as long as she can put up with. And then one day she turned around and she said to me, she said, "Look, you need to either go get help or I'm leaving." Now, naturally, the first thing that popped into my head was, "Go ahead, go. Then I ain't got to be responsible for you no more," which I really was anyway, you know. "I'm tired of hearing you nag." See, my head will tell me 1,000 different things, and I'll believe them all because it lies to me. My alcoholism will lie to me if I let it. And after a couple half-assed vain attempts, she turned around and she told me one day, she says, "I can't take this no more." She says, "You either get straightened out or I'm not hanging around." And this was my first bout with, how do you call it? Sobriety. That's about the best. That's what I call it, sobriety. A dry drunk, God forbid. You know, sitting there with the coins in my hand, you know, going to 5 or 6 meetings a day. White knuckling, not using, not drinking every single day. And then finally one day after like, I think, 92 days, I went down the corner to get a paper, a pack of cigarettes, and came home 7 days later. With one flip-flop, no shirt, and a pair of shorts, half a pair of shorts. And you know, when I walked out that door, I really honestly meant to go to the corner store and get a pack of cigarettes and a paper. But as I walked out that store, out of that store, I can still remember vividly today my head telling me, "Go down the bar, you can have one. Go see your old friends, see how everybody's doing. You just controlled it for 3 months." You know? And as we all know, first step of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that I'm powerless over controlling whether I pick up that first drink. My willpower is non-existent. But I didn't know that, because all I was being told was, "Just don't drink, you'll be a winner. Come around, set up chairs. Oh, we need somebody today to mop the floor." I said, "What am I? I said, what am I here, trying to get sober, or am I your janitor? I mean, are you going to cut half of that basket and put it in my pocket? Because I'm here 8 hours a day. I know you're collecting a nice chunk of change there. You know, I washed every friggin' ashtray in this joint every day for a week." "Well, that's what you're supposed to do." "Oh, yeah? Okay. How am I supposed to live? How am I supposed to go out into the world and get a job and all that?" "Oh, just hang on. Hang on." I didn't know how to hang on. And then I would go through the bouts of 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. I think I had 366 days one time. I finally made it to a year. This is like my first 2.5 years around AA. And I couldn't do it. I actually seriously thought that I was possessed by demons and went to my parish priest and asked him to perform an exorcism on me, because normal people don't do what I do. He says, "That's right." He said, "Normal people don't do what you do." He says, "Godless people do what you do." Just like that. And I went, how dare this guy? I know who God is. He's the supreme being who created all things. That's what the catechism taught me in first grade. But I didn't know who God was. To be honest with you, I had a big, deep resentment towards God. I hated God. I hated God for making me walk the face of this earth every day. I hated the fact that God put me through this turmoil every day. What did I do that was so wrong that you got to punish me like this? I used to talk to God like that. You know? For 2.5 years I floundered around. I call it poison AA. Okay? Because it's not the Alcoholics Anonymous that I've learned to recover through. I don't even know where this AA came from that these people were talking about, to be honest with you. Some kook box psychologist in a rehab probably made it up. You know, I used to call them the puzzle shops. You know, you would go in these places, they would take your head apart, they'd tell you everything that was wrong with you, you know, to humiliate you. Don't you think I humiliated myself enough? They wouldn't shave my head and put me in a diaper in a playpen in Eagleville. And I said to the guy, I said, what does that have to do with alcohol and drug therapy? He said, well, it's humiliation therapy. I said, dude, I humiliated myself enough. I said, come on, I lost my family, my father, mother, don't want nothing to do with me. I can't walk through the neighborhood without the cops picking me up and beating the shit out of me. All right? I live in a car under I-95. I said, don't you think that's humiliating enough? Well, I don't know. You're still drinking and drugging. I said, yeah, to take me out of pain. For the 10 minutes or 5 minutes or 3 minutes, wherever it worked, it took me out of the pain of living every day. But I didn't know this. See, until I met this guy one day who I was told actually to stay away from. This guy lived in Philadelphia, was wanderer, drunk. He was actually, I think, running from the mob in Vegas. He beat them out of some money for one of them like side poker game things. And he wound up in Cleveland. And wound up in a clubhouse out in Cleveland. That was actually a home group of Clarence Snyder. And they got a hold of him out there, and he came back here and brought the message back here. And I remember walking down them steps and watching this guy float down the aisle. And that's what it looked like to me. Like, he didn't look like he had a care in the world. And he had about a 12-hour outfit on. He had like $4 sneakers on, Wranglers, and a plaid shirt that he looked like he just got off of Captain Kangaroo. You know, he had a cup of coffee in his one hand and he had this big fat blue book under the other hand, under the arm. And he came up to me, he handed me a cup of coffee, he extended his hand and welcomed me. And to be honest with you, I had been to probably about 1,500 AA meetings in the past 2.5 years, and I think I know about 4 people. Because most of the people that I had run across were either sitting in a chair thinking about what they were going to share. Okay? They had a good day. They had a bad day. There was one guy that used to go around and to like the 7-8 meetings I would go to every day and complain about the same thing in the same meeting every day. And I actually went to the guy next to me one day. I said, if he complains about this one more time, I'm getting up and I'm beating him up. But this guy, he wasn't talking about stuff like that. He wasn't talking about having a good day. He says, as a matter of fact, every day he wakes up in the morning is a good day. He said, because he knows that God put him on this earth for a purpose. I said, well, what did he put me on this earth for? To create havoc and, you know, wreak havoc among people and be this drunk, degenerate addict and rob from people? He said, no. He says, he didn't. He said, God put you on this earth to help his children. He says, and when you get your head out of your ass, he says, and stop feeling sorry for yourself and maybe do something to change your life. He said, you'll understand what I'm saying. I said, but I don't know what to do. He says, I do. And I walked right into it. I took the bait. And he started opening this book and started showing me all different things in this big book. And then we sat down for the meeting, which was only about 12 people. And all these people were sharing about how their life was and how it is today. And nobody was sharing about how they had a good day that their car started. Or they had a bad day because the dog pissed on the rug. Or, you know, the milk was sour and they couldn't make their coffee in the morning, so they wanted to go shoot dope. You know, things like that. And nobody was telling me that I had to go get on SSI. And nobody's telling me, you know, like I can't be a productive member of society. All they were telling me is that they had a solution to my problem. And it caught my ear and I wanted to know what they had. I kept going back there for about 2.5 months. And finally, after going through some more of Frank's way, you know, going back to that priest and him telling me that I have an absence of God in my life, starting to put two and two together a little bit and get beat up a little bit more, I finally woke up to this guy and I said to him, I said, Andy, I said, whatever you ask me to do, I'll do. I don't care what it is. I said, if you want me to shove a pole up my ass and walk up Broad Street with a flag on it, I'll do it. I'm not going to ask you no more questions. I don't expect anything out of this anymore. I said, I just want to stop living the way I'm living. I just want to stop hurting people. You know? I just want to stop feeling that misery every day. Because let's face it, by this time, there wasn't enough alcohol in the face of the earth to take me out of my head. It stopped working years before. But it was the only solution that I ever knew. This guy offered me a new solution to life. He told me everything that you ever tried to do to get well. He said, did it work? I said, no. He said, that's because you try the same things over and over again. He said, the book tells me you need to recreate your life. Well, how do you recreate your life with the same sick head? He said, very simple. He said, you just listen to me and do what I tell you to do. You know? And I didn't care. I really didn't care what I had to do. You know, and I was living in this car under 95, about 2 blocks from where I actually took my first drink. And I started to read this book, and it was probably the first real book that I read that didn't have naked ladies in it or cartoon characters in a long time, you know. And I started to see a lot of truth in this book. These people were talking about me, and I was wondering how they found out about it. You know, how did these people write a book about me? How did they know me? And the funny thing about it is, as I start reading this book and start going through this process, the thoughts of drinking and doing the other things started to leave. I came to believe that whatever was fixing these people in this room would fix me and it wouldn't leave me out. And they all told me the same thing. I came to believe in a power greater than themselves, a higher power. A conception of God. And here's God again. So I turned around and I said to my sponsor, I said to him, I said, Andy, I said, I thought God put me in this position. He said, no, he didn't. He says, by you keeping God out of your life, you wound up like this. Your selfishness and self-centeredness got you here. He said, but what we need to do is we need to turn your will in life. You need to be willing to turn your will in life over to God from this point forward. Which is our third step. And I balked at that. I had a little problem with that. But the one thing that always stuck out at me was at the top of page 63, it said, when we do this thing, all sorts of remarkable things follow. He provides what we need as long as we keep close to Him and perform His work well. Okay? I woke up to my sponsor and I said, what is God's work? You know, he says, helping his kids. Unconditionally. You know, unconditionally. Not helping them because you're using them like a bag of dope. You got to have 72 sponsors to fill your void with. He goes, guess what? If you're really grounded in this thing, you're not doing this anyway. Because as we go along through this process, we build a faith and trust in a God of our understanding. Okay? And as we start to go through this process, we start to see how more and more God-reliant we are and how less and less we are reliant in self. So if I'm still searching for an answer and I'm using this poor slob to get me through the day who's dying, then I got a problem, don't I? And the funny thing about it is that when I finally got through this process, and I'm not going to sit here and explain every experience that I had. I did the work. I didn't ask questions about it. Every step that I went through, I had some sort of spiritual experience with. And I carried it into the next step. Okay? There were things like faith, hope, trust, courage that came back into my life that I never ever had unless I put a drink or a drug in me. And it was all coming from God. It wasn't coming from me. I was able to go out into the world and face these people face to face. I never looked any man in the face. I could tell you what kind of shoes you had on or what kind of nail polish you had on your toes. You know? But to be able to sit up and look at you in the face and be a man one-on-one, no. I didn't have the courage to do that. God gave me the courage to be able to do that. God gave me the courage to be able to tell the truth, to be honest. I didn't know what honesty was. I was honest even when I lied, as far as I was concerned. You know? Today I know what being honest is. Because I can sit up here and talk all kinds of good shit. But my friends know how I live. The people who know me throughout AA over the years know what I'm about. I don't hide behind anything today. I don't have to hide from no man. I can walk down the street upright, righteous, on my own 2 feet today, walking hand in hand with the Spirit. Because I've experienced that. I know that when I get in the way of things, I am in trouble. And it happens every day, thank God. Because you know what? If it didn't, I would think that I'm some sort of spiritual giant, you know? But I mess up every day. And I thank God that when I do my 11th step at night, I can see it. And I can be honest with it. And I ask God to remove it and I move on. But I think the funniest experience I had was I went through this process with the help of this man. And the funny thing was is when he first started helping me, he said, I'm not your friend. I'm not your banker. You can't sleep over my house. I'm not buying you cigarettes. I'm not feeding you. You know, he says, I'll take you through this process. He says, and if God willing, things work out okay, we actually might be friends somewhere down the line. And he is still my friend today. You know? And the funny thing about it is we don't sit there and constantly talk recovery every time we talk. We talk about fishing. We talk about his grandchildren. He just retired. And, you know, we talk about normal life things. You know? And we are friends. And I know that I can call him tonight if I really needed him. You know? And he would be there for me. But I know what his first answer out of his mouth would be. Did you call God first? He told me way back when I tried to call him about 60 times one night. In between my third and fourth step, he says, did you make a decision to turn your life over to God? I said, yeah. He said, well, call him and leave me alone. And he gave me the choice. He always gave me the choice. I can either do what I need to do, or I can go to the other solution, which I left. And I knew that that wasn't the solution I wanted to go towards. And as I went through this process and I got to the end of it, I walked up to him and I said to him, I said, Andy, let me ask you a question. He said, what's that? I said, when am I going to have this spiritual awakening? Because I really didn't know. I wasn't looking for it. I thought that, the angel Gabriel was going to sit on my bedside and anoint me with oils and, give me, fancy sandals to wear or some shit, And he said, let me ask you a question. He says, how are you living today? I said, life's okay. He said, life is okay. He said, when's the last time you could actually sit back and honestly say that life is okay? I said, I never could. He said, how's that car hotel that you live in doing? I said, I haven't lived in there in a while. I said, a friend actually helped me get a place to live, and the landlord lets me work off my rent by fixing stuff around the building. He said, really? Somebody did that for you, huh? I said, yeah. He said, when's the last time anybody would do anything for you? I said, I don't remember. I said, most people wouldn't even want me around them. He said, how do you feel today? I said, I feel great. I said, I took a bath. I said, I worked a little bit. I just feel good. My head's not running and everything. He said, let me ask you a question. What were you doing when I came in? I said, I was talking to that new guy over there, trying to tell him about how I was and what happened to me and where I'm at now and how good life is. He went, how about that? How good life is. Even when life is bad, it's good today. And trust me, my life is not a bowl of peaches and cream, I mean, I got laid off last September. Financially, it's been rough, but God provides. My landlord put my house up for sale. I didn't know what I was going to do because I exhausted my savings. I actually had a friend of mine call me up and tell me, I'm selling my mother's house. You're welcome to move in until you can find something, okay? We drew up papers the other day, I'm buying it. And she's going to hold the mortgage. And it's in the asshole of the world, and I don't care. I got drug dealers walking up and down my street every night. It's mayhem. But you know what? I believe God puts me in places for reasons, And it's okay. I have a roof over my head. God provides, And I can go on and on and on with stories like this. But I know one thing, too. I know that back in 1980, when I originally got sober, I did this pretty much religiously for a long time. And then one day I stopped because I thought that I didn't have to do it anymore. I sponsored all these people. Let them go out and help the minions, I just want to sit back and observe. I want to enjoy all the rewards that God has given me. All right? And in March of 2003, I wound up in a detox. Okay? With a drug habit that would choke Seabiscuit. Wondering how I got there. I know all about all this stuff. I shouldn't be here. Why am I here? Well, the book tells me why I was there. It tells me all I have is a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Every day is a day when I must carry the message of God into all my activities, not just the ones that I feel that I have to. I don't get to pick and choose this. It's not the way it works. When I signed up for this thing, it was all or nothing. Okay? And it didn't happen overnight. It slowly deteriorated over a course of 3.5 years. And the one thing I can remember my sponsor saying was, when I first came into this program has to be the most important thing in your life. Otherwise, you won't have a life. If you're an alcoholic like me. If you're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety like me. And I experienced that also. Okay? He used to always tell me, he'd say, you'll never see me celebrate my anniversary. He says, I don't count time. I don't carry chips and coins around in my pocket to remind me of how long I'm sober. He said, because all I have is today. He says, if I don't get up tomorrow and do what I did today, he says, there's a chance that I can drink. He said, that's how cunning, baffling, and powerful this disease is. All I need to do is give it one little 60 millionth of a millimeter of a hole to sneak through and start talking to me. Okay? And I didn't believe it. Especially when things ain't going good. If I'm not practicing these principles in all my affairs, not just here, all my affairs. You know, I try to be a good neighbor today. I try to help my friends today. It's a joy to be of service into the world because I wreaked so much havoc on them for so many years. And God has given me a second chance. And I believe that this is my purpose. To carry peace on earth and goodwill towards all men. And to be an example of what this thing is about. You know? And sometimes I fall short of that. But you know what? I recognize it today. And it doesn't take too long to. Which I thank God for. I have a relationship today that I couldn't buy in any stage store or street corner. I have a feeling in my life today that is beyond my wildest dreams. Am I rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence? I don't know what that is. You know? I like to actually believe that there is still room for growth. I hope so. I don't actually think that I've even scratched the surface of what this thing could be about. But I know this. I don't think about drinking today. I don't think about drugging today. You know, when life comes along and it's shitty, I say a prayer, I move on with it and leave it in God's hands and be out of the way, and it usually works out. So the least I worry about my life, the better off I am. Amen to that. So I like to end with this. If you're new, listen to what I'm saying. Don't waste your time having good days and bad days. All right? If you're an alcoholic like I am, get somebody to help you that's experienced this thing. Ask the man for help. Okay? It was one of the most humbling experiences I think that I could have ever done. You know, and guess what? It was the best. Because it saved my life. And I also like to say this, that I know that, you know, there's a lot of people that come around here and say that they're doing this thing. And if you're not, ask somebody to help you. Put your pride up on the shelf. If you're struggling, if life's not going the way you think it should be, don't be proud. You know, I'd rather you come up with your tail between your legs and ask for help than have to put a flower on your box and throw dirt in your face. Because I've had that happen too. I buried a lot of friends in AA. Trust me. And I know one that they're not burying. That's me. Not by this cause anyway. Cunning, baffling, powerful. It will kill you. But maybe not today. So I'd like to thank Dave for asking me. I'd like to thank you all for having me. God bless you. Thank you.